From the sermon series, the book of Job, we come to our second sermon. Job curses his life, and we've already heard that reading of Job, which, as I heard it being read, caused me to think a lot. On the morning of the 4th of July, I began my day by reading the Declaration of Independence, which sets forth the American colonists' reasons to separate from Great Britain's tyranny and their aspirations for a new nation conceived in liberty and the rights endowed by their creator. Upon turning on my computer and going online, I saw a link to an article about some fringe group dismissing the Declaration as a form of hate speech. For me, the Declaration has always been the source of the great words Abraham Lincoln used in his wonderful speeches to proclaim freedom from slavery. Those are the same words a woman's movement used to win their right to vote in the beginning of the 20th century. And from the Declaration of Independence, Martin Luther King preached his messages of equality. Later that same morning, we received a phone call from the daughter of my lifelong friend, John, who was hospitalized and wanted me to come up that day and see him. Before leaving on vacation last month, I touched base with John to see how his new experimental treatment for pancreatic cancer was working. For just over a year since Memorial Day last, John had been receiving treatments for that dreadful cancer, which was discovered, ironically, when he underwent tests for kidney stones. Needless to say, John's life has been turned upside down since then. And yet, with almost no complaint at all, he kept up both his treatments and his faith. That day, John said he felt so good that he went out and mowed the lawn with his prized riding mower. As we concluded our phone conversation in early June, John wished me a good vacation and commented on how he couldn't wait for September to come when he and his family would be renting the same place we were headed to in Maine, on the water facing Rockland Harbor and the islands leading out to the ocean. For years, John's family and ours had vacationed together, and John loved the peaceful calm this seaside oasis gave him. Upon viewing an extremely beautiful sunrise one morning, I sent it to John on his cell phone for him to dwell upon and look forward to in the summer days ahead. I truly had hoped John would be able to make the trip and see his own sunrises. However, upon arriving at Bryn Mawr Hospital late the afternoon of July 4th, we were taken back by John's tremendous loss of weight and his almost skeletal appearance. He was beginning to look like a Holocaust survivor. His wife, Barbara, informed us that John had not slept since she brought him to the hospital the Saturday before. All John could do was repeat his wish over and over again to go home where he could get some peace and quiet. When everyone left the room to take a break and leave me alone with my friend of 59 years, he said to me, "Jeff, I'm done. All I want to do is die in peace." And finally, he fell asleep, but only for 10 short minutes. Only to awake again in his former agitated state, expressing his desire to go home. This morning in our second and sixth texts from the book of Job, we meet another agitated man. After learning of the deaths of his seven sons and three daughters, he remains silent, strictly silent, for 7 days, not having sinned with his lips, but apparently displaying ever-deepening signs of interior agony. Now Job opens his mouth and curses the day of his birth. That day through which one is introduced to this life and the goodness of all creation. That day of annual remembrance and celebration which renews one's participation in the goodness of this created life. That day through which a now cursed Job perceives it as being given entry into the bitterness of the soul and a new sense of enmity with God, as the name Job in Hebrew can be translated as one whom God is treating as an enemy. Remember in last week's introduction to this summer series of sermons on the book of Job, we learned that the book is composed of two completely different sections. There is the fable of Job, which forms the prologue, chapters 1 and 2, and the epilogue, chapter 42. Then there is the poem of Job, which comprises the intervening 39 chapters, with its cycles of spoken dialogues between Job and his so-called friends, and the final monologue that is delivered to Job by God. The fable with which we are most familiar with presents Job as a pious, righteous, upright man who has been blessed with a large family and riches beyond imagination. The fable tells us that one day God and Satan entertain a wager, a bet, to see whether or not this righteous, obedient Job would remain faithful if all his blessings were taken away from him. Following the losses of his material wealth and his children, we are told this in the fable. Despite all that, Job did not sin or cast any reproach upon God. The fable concludes with chapter 42, as the venerable, pious, and still faithful Job has everything restored to him. Today, with our readings from chapter 3, 4, and 7, the book of Job begins to become the most challenging book to understand in all the Bible. The poem of Job is one of the most sublime creations in all biblical literature. Sir Alfred Lord Tennyson, who knew something about poetry himself, called it the greatest poem of ancient and modern times. The poem of Job asks difficult questions like, do we really live in a world that rewards people for being honest and charitable? And if so, how are they rewarded? Or does God really care about the kind of person I am? And can a religious person be angry at God, even doubt God's existence, and still think of oneself as a religious person? The poem of Job does not have an answer to those questions, but it does have some interesting answers, as we will discover. It invites us to look at the world through the eyes of several characters, some who challenge God, some who try to step in and defend God, and ultimately from the viewpoint of God himself. The author of the poem totally leaves the fable behind. There are no more references to God's wager with Satan. And he feels no need to justify a God who kills innocent people in order to win a bet. Instead, there is a no-holds-barred argument about God's rule in this world, the likes of which we find nowhere else in the Bible. While scholars cannot come to agreement on when this poem was written, they at least agree that chapter 3 marks the place where the book of Job shifts from prose to poetry, where Job loses his famous patience and becomes angry. where Job ends the silence and begins to speak at length. Then Eliphaz appears as the first of three friends who have come to comfort Job in his misery. After that, Job receives Bildad, then Zophar, ending the first cycle of dialogues. The poem then follows with a second cycle, with tempers growing steadily shorter, and with Job offering rejoinders to each one of his friends' remarks. A third cycle ensues and degenerates into total confusion, with the participants losing patience with each other, shouting and interrupting one another, and setting the stage for the unforgettable monologue from God, which will conclude this poem. Returning now to our text, after a 7-day period of strict silence, Job releases his pent-up emotions, cursing not God, but the day he was born. Job does not directly curse God, as the adversary Satan had predicted in the fable, but his turgid, bombastic language gives evidence that Job feels that the whole created order of the world has come apart. Job then turns from cursing to questioning, using a series of rhetorical questions that all of his friends will seek to answer. His key word throughout this section will be a word we use a lot: why. Job concludes his initial lament with 4 rhetorical knife-like stabs expressing his pain and frustration. Like my friend John, Job verbalizes, "I have no peace, no quietness. I have no rest, only turmoil." I thought of this passage when the nurse came in and asked John 2 questions the other night. "What is your name?" Which he couldn't answer. "When were you born?" Which he could. 3:25:47. Like Job, he did not curse God. He didn't even curse the day he was born. Only when Yahweh appears in chapter 38 with his own set of questions will Job find the peace that eludes him. Beloved people of God, Job's initial speech, cursing the day he was born, is startling in its intensity. And for that reason, it can be troubling to those who try to read this book. And yet, we need to be aware of this, that strong emotions and incisive questions do fit into a life of faith. Viewed from within the larger context of the entire book of Job, and even the entire Bible for that matter, Job raises key questions all of us have come to ask at one time or another in our lives. Overall, the Job we meet in the poem articulates his most troubling thoughts and deepest pains so that he can seek to understand his adversity in light of his commitment to God, as Jesus later did prior to and during his crucifixion. Job does not deny or dilute the pain he feels, but rather expresses it openly and honestly. Job does not address his lament to God, but his candid recognition of his pain is a necessary first step in the direction to faith. As Job will come to realize, feeling deeply and speaking from the depths of pain are not inherently sinful. Just as parents understand when their children are speaking out of their frustration and hurt, they want their children to turn to them at these difficult times. So God desires that we just be open and honest with him and turn to God. We do not have to wait until we have calmed down and gotten things under control before we can speak to God. Like Job, we need to remember that our understanding of God is limited, and we need to learn that we will never be able to comprehend all that God is doing in our lives. We all need to hear that message. I needed to hear it last night. At 7:15, I received a phone call that John found his eternal peace as he breathed his last breath. Amen.